Hello everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to a live Sydney Writers Festival edition of Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin today by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Claire and I are recording this special live episode of Archive Fever, direct from Sydney Writers Festival. Today, we're gathering on unceded Gadigal country. This land was stolen and Gadigal sovereignty was never ceded. We acknowledge Gadigal elders past and present and pay our respects to any Indigenous people in the live audience or listening via the podcast.
And we'd also like to thank this lovely Sydney crowd for turning up today for our Peak Nerd podcast.
So today on Archive Fever, we're talking strong female leads, which Claire has on her t-shirt in case you forget. So how does the archive shape and limit the stories we tell about powerful women? What does it feel like to be immersed in the life of someone else? And what does it mean to celebrate powerful women when Australia is still, in many ways, a man's country? Well, to help us answer these questions, we're joined by two guests who've recently documented the life and times of two of the most influential women in recent Australian history. First, towards that end, we have literary biographer Bernadette Brennan. Bernadette is a critic and researcher of contemporary Australian writing and one of the five judges of the Miles Franklin Award. Her literary criticism has been published widely in Australia and abroad. Bernadette's publications include Brian Castro, The Seductive Play of Language, and A Writing Life, Helen Garner and Her Work. And her most recent book is Leaping into Waterfalls, a biography of the novelist Gillian Mears. Please welcome Bernadette Brennan.
Then sitting next to Eve is filmmaker Tosca Luby. Tosca Luby has been directing high-end factual programming for the past two decades. She has created complicated thesis-dependent works on issues including international child abduction, contemporary parenting, and domestic violence. In 2021, she created Strong Female Lead, a feature documentary made from 100% archival material, which charts the sexism that came at Julia Gillard during her prime ministership. In the same year, Tosca released the critically acclaimed three-part series, See What You Made Me Do, fronted by journalist Jess Hill. She's now completing an ABC art series and embarking on a new series with Jess Hill, this time tackling the issue of consent. Her awards and nominations include the Rose D'Or, ACTA, Logie, AIDC, Walkley, and Asian Academy Creative Awards for Best Documentary Series. Bernadette and Tosca, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tosca, you've been making deeply researched documentaries for several decades now. So as far as filmmakers go, you're clearly an archive addict. When did you first get the research bug?
That makes me feel really old. Between finishing school and studying university, I went to Vietnam. And I was travelling and went to a museum that was full of great big jars of fetuses. And they were all very misshapen human fetuses, and it was all the impact of Agent Orange on display. And that sent me on a, I think it's moments like that when, maybe for all of us, when you're curious, that lead you down an archive road. And so from there, I I created a thesis on the impact of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and I guess from that point on just kept looking for the next story, and it tended to be moments that I saw, things I got curious about, and that's the beauty of being a documentary maker. You can kind of become an expert in something for a year and then you move on to something completely different, and all of it has involved archives.
And what does it feel like for you when you're kind of in the grip of that research for a new project? Do you feel kind of intoxicated or like you're in the pool of an addiction?
I think, why is everyone not doing this? Exactly. You know, I mean, this is clearly the most fascinating thing that is going around at the moment. And I can, you know, I start telling everybody about it and their eyes glaze over, and I realise that actually, no, I'm really caught in something. And it's not necessarily shared by the rest of the population.
And what about you, Bernadette? You started out in academia, working in English literature at Sydney University. Is that when you first developed a passion for research, or does it date back earlier?
Probably in my undergraduate year and then honours year. I remember, it must have been about third year, they brought in what was called then cultural studies, which was so radical and new, and it was going to throw over the whole canon and we're all going to lose our ability to read literature, etc. But we had two teachers who said, basically, go and write a long essay on anything you like. And in one class, someone had mentioned Charmian Clift. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this sounds like an interesting person. And so I went to the State Library and started looking up Charmian Clift. And then I went back to all the old Thurunkers and the Honiswar later, but it was the Thurunker papers. And I thought, okay, this is fascinating. And it was the front cover of Thurunker, and it was 1968. And it was a tall woman in a tiny miniskirt. And it was something like, we demand the pill now. And these sorts of things. I thought, okay, this is fascinating going back doing that. As then, you know, an academic, you delve into the archive for whatever you're writing or whatever you're researching. But when it really got me was when I left academia and thought I was going to be spending quite a bit of time in Canberra, and I just looked up the National Library archives and thought, what's here that I could get my teeth into? And suddenly there was this embargoed archive of Helen Garner's, and some of them were embargoed till 2035. And I thought, now that's got me interested.
And when Forbidden fruit.
And I thought, there's got to be something in there that is interesting. And when she gave me permission to have access, I was hooked. And I can just echo Tosca's ideas that why isn't the rest of the world doing this? And also, who cares about the rest of the world? Because the only place and the happy place is here right now in this archive. And suddenly the whole world seems to reflect your archive and what you're looking at, and you don't understand why everybody's not thinking the same way. But obviously we're nerds.
And Bernadette, you expressed that in terms of affect, but do you feel that in your body as well? Is archive fever something that grips you on that more corporeal level?
It does. And the word addiction is absolutely right, because people say to me now, so who's your next biography going to be on? And I keep saying, I never intended to be a biographer. I really didn't mean to. But once I'd been in that Garner archive, there was no way I was giving up that thrill again, and that whole immersion of self. And it simply became a matter of who's got the next biggest, best, most intriguing archive that I can go to. So that's where it grips me, yeah.
So you're waiting for the next drug to come along and pull you under.
Totally.
Tosca, your documentary, Strong Female Lead, which is incredible, tells the story of Julia Gillard's prime ministership using only archival footage. There's no commentary, voiceover, there's no talking heads. It's just news footage largely from the time. Why did you decide to make the documentary that way?
So it was always the intent. It was really important that's how we did it. And that was because we didn't want to use the luxury of hindsight. Mm. So we wanted to say, you can argue, as academics have and everyone else has, you know, since Julia Gillard's time, whether it was sexist or not, but you can't argue with what actually did happen at the time. And so we wanted to kind of take all the noise away and funnel everyone into what actually was happening a lot behind the scenes. So there are a lot of things that people didn't know about. There's kind of instances that everyone, when you talk about Julia Gillard and sexism, they say, oh yeah, you know, the carbon rallies, that was terrible. But there was so much more. And we felt in order to demonstrate, it could only be archives. At one point we thought we would get Julia Gillard to speak at the end, and she was willing to do that. But then when we got to the end, it just was clear that at that point it wasn't just her story. Then it was a bigger story, and it wasn't appropriate. It was to hear from her now or a reflection back. It was about going forward.
And so once you decided to make the film all around archives, I mean, there must have been hundreds and hundreds of hours of archival footage you could have used. How did you go about finding it, and how did you go about shaping it all into a kind of coherent story?
Oh, we've only got an hour. Okay, so it was lockdown. We were actually working on a different series that we were out filming, and suddenly we got locked down. And so we went begging to SBS, saying, please just let this film through ahead of time so we can get going on it. And they said yes. So four of us, so myself, the editor, Rachel Grissom-Johns, Laura Grace, who is the archivist, and an assistant editor, all went home, and we'd passed these massive hard drives between us every Friday. And so I would say, okay, we're interested in this particular moment that I think is going to give us something. And I would give Laura some kind of clue, like, okay, around June in 2011, there was an incident between Abbott and Gillard, and it happened in Parliament, I don't know which day, and that would just send us off on having to pull hours and hours and hours of parliamentary archive, looking at what news came out at that time, going through radio, looking for keywords. It really was about having a massive jigsaw puzzle and kind of working it backwards. So yeah, it was incredibly complicated, and you always felt that no matter what you found, there might be more. So we never felt we could get to the end of the journey. You know, there was always more to pick up, but we were bowerbirds and we were just taking it from everywhere. And the other thing that was really important to the process was talking to people who were in Parliament at the time. So I did a lot of conversations with people who would tell me their reflections, all completely off the record. So I had some amazing conversations. And because it was lockdown, I was in an office with my husband. He kept saying, that was an amazing interview. What a pity you're not actually interviewing them. And I'm like, yeah, but they're not going to say any of that if I've got a camera in front of them. This is completely off the record. But it was exactly what I needed, because they could say, well, I do remember this thing that happened, that, you know, some sledging that may or may not have been on mic in Parliament. And then we go chasing what we could find. So, yeah, a lot of it we couldn't put in the film because there wasn't that evidence, but we know it happened.
But Tosca, I believe, you know, you've just described this incredible rich archive, but I believe when you first mooted the documentary, people questioned whether you'd even be able to find enough to put together an ad length, let alone a full feature. And then that just reminded me, when I started my book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, people would say, oh, what could you possibly say about the Eureka stockade that hasn't already been said? Do you think that that is a kind of sexist response in itself, that there couldn't possibly be enough material about a woman to make something about a woman?
Yeah, I think it is indicative of the fact that people really had no idea what happened.
Now, Bernadette, your book, Leaping into Waterfalls, also draws upon a huge archive, the personal papers of Gillian Mears, who died in 2016. I believe her archive is one of the biggest personal collections at the State Library of New South Wales, extending to 154 boxes in total. Now, it's quite rare for a kind of contemporary writer to have such a big personal archive in a public repository. Can you tell us how that came to exist?
Yeah, sure. First, I'd like to say, everything you say, Tosca, I can see when I'm watching your documentary, you think, my goodness, the number of hours you must have looked through to pick those out and weave them together so well. But also the process, interestingly, I could say, maps on exactly to mine. So even though I'm using words, you're using film, it's extraordinary, the connection. So Gillian Mears left an archive at the State Library, which is the largest literary archive that they have, and it's the second archive in size only to the Fairfax archive at the State Library. I had no idea of this when I started. I was told that there was probably a few scrapbooks in the State Library. So I looked up their catalogue, and their catalogue was going through a changing system at the time. So they only had some of it there. So I then went in to meet them, and there was lots of issues about getting access. But yes, there is this phenomenal archive. From the age of about five, Gillian kept every single piece of paper, and she put it into her archive. Now, that is extraordinary because she was younger than me. So we're not talking, you know, a sort of doyen of, you know, 90-something years old that has built this career. She had this sense of herself that this was worthwhile and this was going to be interesting to others. So that was fascinating. And in that archive is all sorts of things like possum fur and eagle's wings and lots of flowers and 6,000 photographs and hours of recordings and every birthday card and school report, reams of text messages because she had severe multiple sclerosis and couldn't use her hands for the last few years, so she had voice recognition, as well as millions of pages of diaries and thousands of letters and other stuff. So it came about because she collected it all. And then at different stages of her life, she decided, I'm broke, as most writers do, and the only way she could make money was to donate that to the State Library. To start with was a tax break when she'd got a good contract on a book, and after that it was that they paid for the archive. Unfortunately for some people, she sold all their letters without their permission, and they too were young, sort of 30-something year old writers saying, that's a little bit intrusive, and one of them was her lover at the time, and it's sort of, you know, this is not okay. So she lost a lot of friends. And then at another point, she deposited another huge tranche into the archive because she said she wanted to let go of her old life. So it was this idea of, if I could cut free from everything, I could give everything away, which included all the family photographs. So all these photos of her nieces and nephews who are, you know, one and two, and her sisters who have just given birth, they're all in the State Library, and I can see them really easily, and anyone else can if they want to go and look at them. But I sort of think they should be in the family cupboard at home, but that's why it's all there.
And is that common for living writers to sell off chunks of their papers to make money?
Oh, I think it is. Yeah. I think it has been, certainly. And it's certainly why Garner first put her papers in the archive. And it became, it was an Australian tax government, Australian government tax initiative a long time ago. And it was to try and get archives built up and literary archives built up. Tax concessions were given to creatives to deposit their papers in certain libraries. And then after a while, I think that stopped, and then it became a matter of certain libraries having a budget, and so they could pay people for their papers. And they still do. So the State Library, for instance, has quite a healthy budget here to acquire writers' archives. And you just don't know where they're going to go. It's like all the archives you're talking about, Tosca. There's so many of them, and they're everywhere. And one day, a Tosca Luby or a Bernadette Brennan will come along and say, oh, I'm interested in this idea. And suddenly there are these boxes and boxes which lead to other archives. And in the writing ones, as it would be in the film ones, there's a letter then, three letters from Elizabeth Jolly. So I then go to Elizabeth Jolly's archive to see Gillian's letters to her. And then so it goes. The rhizome just takes off.
Bernadette, I'm not a psychologist, I'm an historian, but Gillian Mears appears to have several characteristics that would qualify her for having a narcissistic personality. Do you think you have to be a narcissist, or at least have a really strong ego drive, to be a strong female lead, you know, to be the main character in your own story? Or as one of her friends says, as you quote in the book, that she was always very invested in her legacy?
Interesting question. Do you have to be a narcissist to be a strong female lead? I'm not sure I can answer that. I think she did have traits of narcissism, and she certainly was invested in her legacy. I don't think they're, you know, an either or. And I think it was a matter of an intense self-confidence that said, I matter, and I want to matter, and I want you to know that I matter. At the same time as she lived a life of sort of retiring, crippling shyness, which is another one of her contradictions. Strong female lead. I don't know. Sometimes, and I would suggest, and I'm just going off my own gut reaction here, and certainly at this time in this country, I think you might become a strong female lead if you're angry enough. I'm not sure that it's about narcissism anymore. It might be about not being silent much longer. I don't know. What do you other think? I mean, I don't have any expertise in that area.
I mean, your situation's a bit different, Tosca, because you've made something about a strong female lead. You've called it that, obviously. So there is power in that title. But Julia Gillard herself didn't amass the collection. Her role amassed the collection. What do you feel about that?
It's interesting because she... it's not the story that she wanted to tell about herself at all. And she wasn't very comfortable with it being told, is not very comfortable with it, because she doesn't like the idea that she's the victim and has never wanted to be the victim, and certainly didn't at the time want to be the victim. I think she, she has written her story, and it's a very different story, but it does have a lot of the same elements. And she's certainly come out and said so many things about what happened to her. And, you know, the ending to the film where she says, I think other women should just jump right in, is what she feels, is that... You know, I think just going back to the whole strong female lead idea, it's what you say. She's saying, let's get angry. I don't see her as a narcissist at all. Mm. I think she has all sorts of self-confidence and elements to her personality that made her the right person for the job. But she was angry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could see in the archive... when she first became prime minister, and she's all kind of, I mean, you can see it in the film, she's all like, oh, okay, I didn't even think about what earrings I put on today. And then, you know, you can see her just getting more and more pissed off about these stupid questions people ask her. And then she's not playing nice anymore. She's saying, you know, it's another bit in the film that I just love is when the journalist says, well, you know, it's not like you were off the first train from Adelaide. And she's like, how old are you? to this journalist. And he says, 32. Well, you'll know a lot more by the time you're 50. You know, she's like, I'm just not taking this shit anymore. Yeah. And, you know, so you see a personality change go on. Yeah. And I don't think it's narcissism. I think it's just, you know, it's what we all have.
You get older, you get cross. Yes. Nothing like an older woman.
I'm sort of on this question of the personality of these women. I'm really interested in how you related to them and how that relationship changed over time. Because, you know, they're both strong, complex women and not that different in age to yourself. So what was it like to be so deeply immersed in the life of a kind of female contemporary? Tosca, you go.
It is such an interesting question because you do, and I'm sure you had exactly the same, well, probably even more because it was so sort of physical what you were doing. You get so involved in their life. You feel as though they're in the room next door. And why aren't they talking back to you? You know, it's rude. You know, you're putting so much thought into it. And so I would kind of find myself, and the editor, Rachel Grissom-Johns, because making a film like this is very much a collaboration with an editor. It's not like a normal situation where you've gone out and filmed things and brought things back to an editor. You're really building it together. And so we would have a lot of conversations about what she was thinking and what she was doing and how she would react to parts of our film. We really were second-guessing her all the time. It was like an absent, very present person all the time.
And what about you, Bernadette?
Oh, that was, it's such a torturous journey when you are so immersed. So I would often spend sort of 7 to 8 hours a day just sitting in the uncomfortable chairs at the State Library. And because so much of the archive I was working with was diaries and so personal, and Gillian would record every emotion, every sexual fantasy, everything that went on in her day, everything she ate, every, you know, you lived and breathed this person. And sometimes it was unbearable. Sometimes when she'd had her heart broken, she would fill 40 pages a day of, you know, that bitter, recriminatory kind of language that we all know so well when we've had our heart broken by someone. And you'd get to the end of the day and think, oh, really? I just don't think I can keep going. Or, you know, 3 months later and she starts again on the same ex-lover. And you say, oh, I can't do this anymore, or I really don't like you anymore. Why am I doing this project? And then that happened often with this sort of exasperation. But all I had to do was watch 30 seconds, 90 seconds of an interview, a video that she'd done with someone, or listen to a recording, and I was back. I just thought, no, Gillian, you deserve me to put in this time and you deserve to have this done well and you're worth it and I care. Mm-hmm. The idea about her being about the same age, that was really serious for me because she was 18 months younger than me. I'd met her once. Two reasons. One being that she had lived with multiple sclerosis for 17 years. Diagnosed later than the 17 years, but had lived with phenomenal disability and phenomenal pain for a long time. So that affected me hugely because I thought, as an able-bodied person, this is so important to do the right thing by this writer who was so courageous and who struggled with so much. And also because she chose to take her own life when it became unbearable. That to me also was particularly moving, and because she addressed the biographer all the way through her diary, so biographer of the future, you know, this is what I'd like you to know. And so she was aware that someone was coming along. So I had this feeling of responsibility that you knew this was going to happen, so I need to get this right. So all those things contributed to my emotions up and down. Sometimes I was worried that I was too invested. When I first started, I went out to visit her grave and I got extremely emotional, thinking, I'm not sure if I can do this. And then I thought, okay, you need to be very careful here because as a biographer, you cannot get too close to your subject. Except that they were not only speaking back to me, they were in my dreams and they were in the car with me and they went walking with the dog, and that subject was everywhere. So that becomes immersive and overwhelming and sometimes wonderful and sometimes a bit hard to take.
And what's that relationship like now that you've finished the book? Like, does it feel like you've sort of walked away from her, or are you still very immersed in the story?
No, I've walked away. To a large extent, I've walked away. I don't know if I should admit this on radio podcast in a session or whatever, but Gillian, I've always had a thing about the Southern Cross, and when I'm in the Southern Hemisphere, I make a point of trying to locate it every night. It's, I don't know why, I've just always done it. And Gillian was particularly interested in the stars, and when she was dying, when she was going to choose to take her life, her sister said, how will I know if you've made that decision? And she said, you'll know it in the stars. And the night that she did die, her sister woke up and went outside and looked at the sky and looked at the Southern Cross. And it was about the same time that a couple of hundred miles away, Gillian had actually taken the Nembutal. So have I walked away? Yes, but I often talk to her at night time when I walk out. I take the dog out and I look at the Southern Cross and I say, well, Gillian, you know, this is what's going on now. So I haven't quite walked away, but it's getting better.
Bernadette, it sounds like a love affair in itself, and I'm interested in the fact that Gillian wrote so many love letters, and that they become a huge part of the collection. She had an expression for the sort of romances that were fostered through her letter writing. She called them paper passions, which could, as she said, easily transform itself into an out-of-control, dangerous lust. I'm wondering if there is something erotic in the materiality, you know, the tangibility of letter writing, actually, you know, paper and originally pen, or is it possible to have email passion?
Oh, I'd go for the former. Mm-hmm. And certainly Gillian did as well. And so for those who don't know, Gillian Mears was an excessive letter writer, and she actually used letters to form very real friendships, but also to seduce all sorts of people. And she was very interested in seduction. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say a love affair, because I've often said I'm one of the few people who ever met Gillian who didn't fall in love with her. Mm-hmm. And yesterday I was being interviewed by Michaela Kalowski, and I said to her, she met Gillian, and I said, did you fall in love with her? And she said, well, just a little bit, which was just great, because everybody does, because she was a very seductive person. So she seduced a lot of people through her letters, and some of them would then offer to leave their partners, their families, and come and live with her, and she would panic. Oh, no, I don't want to meet you. That's the last thing I want to do, because you're probably not that interesting. I'm really just in love with your writing. Mm-hmm. And when email started to take off, she was furious, and she wouldn't accept email, and she wouldn't accept emails from other people when she finally got an email address. Mm-hmm. And it was only in the early 2000s, when her body was in such a state of disarray that she could no longer hold the pen for long times, that she submitted to emails. Mm-hmm. And they don't hold the same erotic charge. They don't have the beautiful cursive hand and the languorous language that she used. So totally different form of communication.
As well as emails, another new technology that's transformed how we communicate is, of course, social media. And Tosca, one of the things I was really fascinated by with Strong Female Lead was the way you use Twitter and sort of archival tweets to tell the story at key moments. How did you kind of navigate the Twitter archive? How did you even find those tweets, and which ones did you kind of choose to use, and why?
Well, luckily, like everyone getting into any kind of social media archive, I had a young gun who can find anything, and so I sent her on the trail of certain things, you know, and would say, okay, I want to know what people were saying about Gillard immediately after the election. Yeah. And so she'd pull up all this stuff, and, you know, I'd get to go through it. And then, you know, sometimes they were verified and that would make a difference, and sometimes they weren't. And there was so much vitriol. Mm. It was, even I was astounded, and I didn't think I was going to be surprised by what I was finding, but I really was. It was really gross.
And do you think, I mean, people often talk about, you know, social media and Twitter in particular as just being a kind of angry echo chamber of people yelling at each other. Do you think when it comes to the Gillard Prime Ministership, was Twitter a kind of accurate representation of public sentiment?
Well, it was really early days.
Yeah.
So it was right at the beginning. So I think it was much more experimental at that time. But certainly when I look at the archives of Twitter from that time, it does seem to represent what it represents now. I mean, I think there's so much more of it now, but in those early days, it was still very binary, and you were on the attack or you were supporting. And it certainly seemed to be heralding what we have now. And then, you know, Facebook was kind of even worse, and apparently it wasn't just that. People were mailing. There were a lot of people contacting the parliament every day. And I was told that whoever was opening the mail or responding to social media would be on rotation, so they didn't have to see it every day because it was just so nasty.
Tosca, one of the things that I was fascinated by with your Twitter archive, again, I just think it's brilliant, that use of Twitter, is some of the people whose names come up as being on the attack against Gillard or their sexist comments, who I wouldn't necessarily associate now with being antagonists in that sphere. It makes me realise that we see Twitter as being a very ephemeral thing, like, you know, you can just blast off a red wine tweet and think it'll be gone by tomorrow, but it's not gone. So I'm wondering, is Twitter even an open source? Do you have to get permissions to use people's tweets?
Not if it's verified.
Right.
So, that was a hard lesson for some people. and, you know, what's unfortunate is, you race something off. You don't think that 10 years down the track it could be accessed by anybody. Mm-hmm. But here's proof that it can. And, you know, especially for us when we're really looking at a string of what was said at the time, I just felt like I couldn't leave those out, even though I know these are people who weren't necessarily, you know, there were real gradations of what was happening to her at the time. But what it did evidence was that everyone was referencing her clothes and everyone was making those kind of references that they weren't making about male politicians. So there was a point to using those tweets that weren't from people who you would imagine are the usual suspects. But they were still kind of getting involved in this conversation about what she looked like and who her partner was and who else she'd had sex with within the parliament. You know, the fact she didn't have children.
Bernadette, I also want to talk about your relationship with the Mears family, because it's, you know, it's clear from the book and the acknowledgements that you really built up a relationship with trust with them, particularly Gillian's sisters. But, you know, she lived a complex life. There's sensitive material in the book. How did you juggle kind of telling a sort of a true, you know, objective story while maintaining the trust of the family?
Yeah, big and great question. Well, to begin with, I wrote a letter to... So Gillian's one of four girls, and she was the first to die, and so she died in 2016. So in early 2018, I think it was, I wrote to Peter Mears, acutely aware that Gillian's death was still very raw.
Peter's her father,
and said, Gillian had made her three sisters the executors of her literary estate. But I wrote to Peter, and I wrote it in terms of I would like to write this book, why I wanted to write this book, which was about honouring Gillian's legacy as a writer and making sure she wasn't forgotten. It wasn't really motivated by anything more than that I thought this person has had an interesting and brave life. I need to explore it and celebrate her work. But I actually introduced myself as the youngest of seven children who had three sisters and who was a mother with two daughters. And I did that very deliberately because I could understand at that point there were some tensions and complexities in the Mears family. And so Peter and then Yvonne and Sonia said that, yes, they would like to meet me and, yes, I should come to Grafton at the first opportunity. At that point, Karen, who was another sister, was estranged from the family and they were not in contact with her at all and didn't know where she lived. So I went to Grafton and Peter picked me up and took me on the sites. You know, this is where Gillian went to school, this is where she first lived. And I'm saying, oh, can I go and look at the house where she lived with the husband and can I do this? And at one point he said to me, so you come from a big family. Have you ever had any estrangement in your family? And I said, oh, yes, and told him about my family, a little bit about my family history. And there was a visible, you're talking about your bodily reaction to things, there was a visible relaxation. Yeah. As in this person, I think I was glad I was the age I was older. I wasn't here to muckrake. I could understand that families are very difficult organisms. So I think the trust built up just by being honest, being open, but it was never easy because there was all sorts of issues between the three sisters that were still living, and it took a while to understand that at the time none of them were talking to each other, so I would talk to each of them separately. And when I finished and to be ethical, so there were a lot of things I could have said if I wanted to make some sensationalist book. It wasn't my business to do that. My business was to tell readers, this was Gillian's life, it was extremely complex. Because she wrote about these particular things and it's published and you can read stories about these things, which are about her sisters quite obviously, then I can delve into those aspects of their private life to help you understand her writing. But as far as some of the tensions and issues going on in the family that did not directly help you understand Gillian's writing, that was not my business to tell. So that was, for me, actually quite easy to leave out, but I just had to write it in such a way that tried to explain why there is still friction and separation. When I had the manuscript finished or nearly finished or before proofs, I wrote to Peter and each of her sisters and said, would you like to read the manuscript before I send it off for a final edit? And Peter and Yvonne and Sonia said, no, we'll wait for the book to come out. And I was quite relieved, but I was quite happy to send it to them. Karen said, yes, I'd like to read it. And she loved it. And she corrected one or two things, which was great. So I sent it off. And then before it was actually published, Sonia suddenly died from a pulmonary embolism. Mm-hmm. So that was astounding to me. It made me really, really shook me up. And she was a beautiful, beautiful person. Mm-hmm. But there's still frictions going on, and there's two sisters who are estranged, and there's issues going on in the family. So I've just withdrawn and taken a very quiet space. But I'm also acutely aware every time I talk about this in public that, in a sense, do I have that right? Because I'm talking about a family that is not yet working out their own issues. So yeah, it's a fraught territory. Yeah.
Tosca, one of the most shocking things to come out of your film is the kind of outrageous dissonance between the press gallery's response to the sexism at the time, which was a kind of nothing to see here attitude, compared to the fact that what you show through the archive is there was clearly so much to see there. You're not looking back with the benefit of hindsight, as you said before, and you haven't got a scripted narration. You know, we are seeing exactly what played out. I wonder what sort of response you've had to the film from members of the press gallery, who, after all, are still there. They're still members of the press gallery. Are any of them deeply ashamed?
Mm. Yeah. It's actually been a pretty... I was just saying earlier that... For example, I did a podcast with Catherine Murphy from The Guardian, who's been in the press gallery for 14 years, and so she was there all through that time. Mm-hmm. And I was really nervous because I thought, you know, she knows a lot more about this than I do. But as soon as we started, she just sort of did a whole mea culpa and said, I'm really ashamed. Mm-hmm. I don't understand really yet why I didn't see it. I think that I was kind of just responding to what... to always to the kind of political machinations, and I was always suspicious as to why she was saying what she was saying, and so I kind of missed the truth of what was happening to her, even though I knew it was going on. And also, she said I didn't want to make it different for her because she was a woman. I wanted to treat her like everybody else. And it's been really great, actually, hearing from only female, only females from the press gallery who've said, "Yep, that will not happen again." Mm. And we now, you've really done us a favour in creating this document, and we will not allow that to happen again.
Although, interestingly, the one person who emerges as her being her kind of ally from outside of her own party after she stepped down is Rob Oakeshott. And it's a very emotional speech he delivers in the House with Gillard looking on. She's clearly very emotional. Was he really her only ally?
No, she did have other allies. And there were actually, at that time, other beautiful speeches that were given, you know, as they shifted back into Rudd. So no, she definitely did have other allies, and it was far more complicated. I mean, people still point out that, for example, Penny Wong voted for Rudd, and that's true, but it was a really torturous process for her. So it was much more complicated than I supported one or the other from within her party and from without it. But she did have a really interesting relationship with Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott, and that came from the whole hung parliament and the relationship they kind of forged at that time. So, yeah, that the Rob Oakeshott speech definitely stood apart because it was so emotional.
Mm-hmm. Now, Australia clearly has quite a long way to go when it comes to gender equality. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I suppose I'm interested in to what extent telling the stories of powerful women, can that be a kind of weapon against sexism and misogyny in and of itself, by kind of celebrating these women and giving them the respect and the attention they deserve? Do you see your work as a kind of political weapon in this bigger fight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, strong female lead, I have never had anyone from the Labor Party comment on it, not one person. And yet all the independents have come to us and wanted to talk about the film and wanted to use it in their campaigns. So especially all these teal candidates, for example, a lot of Liberal women have come and said, wow, that's not what I thought my party was doing, and I'm pretty disappointed. But it's the independents who've said, okay, if it's going to be like this, because, you know, I really think the film doesn't tell a great story about Labor either. It's not just about what happened via the opposition. It was what happened in Parliament. And so, a lot of independent candidates have come to us and said, I want to use this film to explain why I need to go into Parliament. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, this anger. You know, that's where the film has been picked up and used as a tool.
Yeah, so it's sort of legitimising female anger in Australia.
Yeah.
And what about you, Bernadette? Do you sort of see a feminist politics in kind of raising Mears up as part of the canon of Australian literature?
Yeah, I do. I'll also just say, I just think your strong female lead, the film is just such a powerful, powerful tool and will be for decades, I think, to come. Yeah, I do, because actually Gillian herself was renowned amongst her readership, which was not great. I mean, an Australian readership for Australian books anyway, but for unashamedly naming female desire. And she really had no boundaries in what she would write and how she lived her life as well. And that in itself was transgressive and an assertion of power. I have the right to be a fully sexual being. I can desire whomever I choose. It doesn't matter about gender. It's about who I want to be with at this time. And I'm going to write about that. So to then actually bring her to attention, to make sure she's not forgotten, to celebrate her writing and her life, is to say, this person might make you really uncomfortable. This person might have lived a life that doesn't fit the perfect norms or paradigms of what you think a proper life should be, whatever that may be. But wow, didn't she live? Didn't she live a life? And there's one thing one of her best friends had said. I said, what would you like me to get across? Each person I interviewed about 70 people, and said, what would you like to see in a book about Gillian? And this one very good friend said, well, the thing is, Gillian relished. And that's all you need, Gillian relished. And I think that was what the book was about. And it's why there's a lot of pain and darkness in the book, but a lot of celebratory joy in the book. She relished. She lived a life that she wanted to live. And it took her a long time to find her real voice and to be totally authentic, but she got there. So I think that works for me, yeah.
And for me, Bernadette, I must admit, I had never and still have never read a word of Gillian Mears in my life. I'm aware that she was an author on that kind of scene, but for one reason or another, I've not got there. And what you've made so clear is that she was not only this novelist who won the Prime Minister's Literary Awards for her last novel, Fool's Bread, but wrote all sorts of essays and short stories, was very prolifically published. Having read your book, I now want to read every word that Gillian ever wrote. So what you've done by, in a sense, going through her archive is and reconstructing her life in her own words is, in a sense, prevented her from slipping into a kind of obscurity in terms of her own writing. And I thank you for that. I agree. I think Tosca's film is going to galvanise people, particularly young women, who aren't going to have to wait until they're 50 to get angry. They're going to watch your film and get angry straight away.
Beware, world.
So there's a kind of legacy that you are leaving as well through your words. I mean, you've crafted your own beautiful object. Were you aware of that while you were writing this, of bringing people to Gillian's work, not just the behind the scenes, the archival stuff, but wanting to bring her to her actual, to her published work?
Yeah, that's my motivation for, that was my motivation for the Garner book and for the Mears book. And that's my motivation for everything, which goes back probably to my academic background of legacy. It's about the future. And so it's not about me or my ego. It's about saying, this is a writer that you need to remember. And I've got this student in my head who's, you know, 22 and they're wandering around the stacks of some library that still exists with real books. And maybe they find a Gillian Mears book, or maybe they find my book and for some reason they read it and they think, I now need to go and find this person.
That's me.
Whether that becomes the person in the archive, which is now Gillian Mears, or, you know, because her books are now, you know, digitized somewhere and no longer published, I don't know. But it's about legacy and about do not forget this person because they mattered. And so that's what drives me. And I'm just thrilled that you say that. And readers have just contacted me for the last few months since it's been published saying, I now want to read everything else, or I've gone back to reread it, or I've seen people on Twitter saying, has anyone got a secondhand copy of Map of the Gardens? And I'm just going, yes, my work is done.
Because I noticed, Bernadette, I think in the introduction you mentioned that two of her books were already out of print. Has that changed since you published
the biography? So the State Library has teamed up with another much larger initiative about digitising books, and they've digitised, I think it might have been Radical, I'm not sure, they've digitised her collected stories, I think, or one of those books that were out of print. Paradise is a Place is out of print, and you can understand why, because even back in the day it was sold for $30 or $35. Magnificent book, because it's Sandy Edwards' photographs and Gillian's essay, and it's a landscape orientation, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book. But I'm hoping that a publisher might start to reissue her essays, you know, Alive in Anton B and the essay From Paradise is a Place and those sorts of works that she's done, so that they come back into the readership, because they're works of art, those essays.
Hopefully. Now, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our conversation, but before we close, we'd like to ask you a question we ask everyone here on Archives Anonymous, because it's a safe space, just with a small live audience. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you're willing to share with us? Tosca, you're on the spot.
I literally have a dirty archive secret. So not in Strong Female Lead, but the same editor, so it's all her fault. We did a series for SBS called See What You Made Me Do, and when we were creating it, just for our own reference, we put a frame of really hardcore porn in there. And it was literally, you know, it just went past like that. And it was kind of just a placeholder for us to say, yeah, we've got to find something else to put in there. But it went by so fast that we actually forgot that we'd put it in there. And we showed it to everyone, including the SBS commissioners, who never saw it, or anybody else. It went through quality control. They go through so many processes before they finally make it onto screen. And at the launch party, the commissioning editor kind of walked in pale, and he turned his phone to me and said, "The weirdest thing has happened. They've just done a kind of final run through and they've found this." And I'm like, oh. He said, I'm so sorry that I'm even showing you. I don't know how it got there. I'm like, I do. Yeah, sorry, I forgot about that. You forgot about it? You know, like, he couldn't believe that we had let it almost get to air, which it almost didn't. He's like, what if some kid had happened to stop the television right on that frame? And truly, there were like seven penises in this one. It was pretty full on. Anyway, that's my dirty archive secret.
So maybe choose a scene from Play School for your next play holder.
Yeah. So you caught it just in time, though.
Got it just in time, but literally just in time. Yeah.
Bananas in pyjamas next time.
Yeah.
That'll work.
Can you beat that story?
No, and I don't think I should even try, because that is just, the energy of that story is so good that I think this is one I actually should pass on, even though I could have dirty secrets up to my knees. But no, that one, I'm just going to bow down in front of that, because that is an extraordinary story.
If the SBS commissioner was here, he would be
saying that's not good.
No, okay. It was not good.
Also, Bernadette, can you tell us what you're working on next? Have you got someone in mind?
Well, I have had a few people approach me and ask me if I'd write on their work. And I had said to Drusilla Majeska that I was interested in writing on her work. And I said, but you've done a lot of your own memoir, autobiography, so I wouldn't need to do your life. I could just do something different. No, she said, you'd have to do the life. And took me upstairs and opened a cupboard and said, would you like these? And I came home with a boot full of diaries that haven't yet gone to the National Library. And then it was, but of course, if you needed to understand my life, you'd have to come to the Omni Highlands of New Guinea, where I've spent a lot of time setting up schools and educating children. And she's about to write a book on women and visual art. And I think if I go down that track, I'm going to learn a lot and be pushed past my comfort zone and take me to a new space. So I'm thinking that watch this space, it may be there.
Oh, wow. Well, I'll look forward to that. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. A huge thank you to Bernadette and Tosca for sharing the mic with us today. And thanks also to the Sydney crowd for coming out to share the space with us. For those here today, please run straight to the bookshop. We'll be doing a book signing after this event, and you can get Bernadette to sign the biography. And you could also buy Claire and my book if you like as well.
It's okay, you're allowed. And if you haven't already, please check out Strong Female Lead, which you can find on SBS On Demand.
And you can follow... Oh. And you can follow Bernadette on Twitter at Det Brennan and Tosca Luby at Tosca Luby. And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Rice.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, and 3 of Archive Fever via the website archivefeverpod.com. And photos of all of today's live action will be up there along with this episode. And we'll be bringing you another full season of episodes later in the year. So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded today on unceded Gadigal land and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. Have a great day.
Thank you.